Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. We are continuing our conversations with college and university presidents with Fred Lawrence. He's the president of Brandeis University, where they believe in, quote, truth even unto its innermost parts. President Fred Lawrence, welcome so much to Boston Public Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here. Nice to be with both of you.
Okay, Fred, before we get to what lots of listeners are worried about, how they're going to get their kids through college without having to, you know, like sell everything they own and live in a little cardboard box somewhere, a couple of quirky things.
Sure.
Truth even unto its innermost parts. What does that mean?
I think that means it's about the journey and it's about the vision of trying to pursue issues, even if it takes you in tough places and uncomfortable places, and being open to new experiences. And that's true for my undergraduates, that's true for my graduate students, and that's true for my faculty colleagues and staff.
Oh, I like that.
So
I like that. Now, one more thing, which I did not know until I was preparing for you coming in here today. Smart Balance buttery spread.
Absolutely.
Invented. So is this on the tables? Is this in the cafeteria at Brandeis? You're supporting your alum?
We always support our alumni. Yes, yeah, Smart Balance was actually discovered on the Brandeis campus. And we are, I would say, even better now about trying to see what are the possible applications of the work that we do. We're a basic research university. We don't have a medical school, as most people know. But we have a lot of impact on the world, and Smart Balance is the one that's most likely in your refrigerator.
I love that.
Okay, so I think it's tonight. It may have been last night. I've seen 4,000 promos for it. CNN is doing a documentary. They now do tons of documentaries. The title of it is something like, you've only heard this a million times, is college worth the cost?
Right.
So assuming you were responding to their documentary tonight, what's the answer, Fred Lawrence?
Absolutely. Let me say a couple of things, first of all, about the cost. First of all, going back to how are people going to get through this whole process of putting their kids through school? School like Brandeis, two-thirds of our students are on financial aid. So when people see that big number, they should start by knowing that that applies to about one-third of our students who are fortunate enough and blessed enough to be able to pay that. Two-thirds are on some kind of financial aid. For some, that is a complete free ride that we cover through scholarships from donations and endowment. For some, it's smaller scholarships that can make a big difference. So that's the first piece. Students graduating from Brandeis with debt graduate with an average debt of about $28,000.
Which is the national average, almost to the dollar,
that's
actually.
Right. So now when you think about it, you're asking yourself, is that a good investment? And I think the answer is yes in each of two ways. First of all, I could cost it out in terms of what's likely to happen in people's earning capacity, but that's not really even the biggest picture. This is a life-changing experience in each of two ways. It will make them who they are in terms of their lives as citizens and as members of the society, but it will also make them agile and flexible because they're going to have to re-educate themselves multiple times.
But I'm sure you've heard the stories. We get calls all the time from people who love where they went to school and say, but I wasn't able to enter the career I wanted to enter purely because of my indebtedness. I had to do X instead of be a social worker. I had to do Y. You've heard this all the time.
Sure.
So, I mean, there is a, despite how you're dealing with it, there is a cost issue, which is a significant one that colleges have to address, isn't there?
I think there is, and I think we already are dealing with it in a number of ways. One is trying to bring our cost structure down and much more in line with the economic realities. I'm happy to say that Brandeis is going to have a balanced budget this year for the first time in years. That's not the only thing we're about, but that's part of what we're about.
Is that abnormal, by the way?
Well, you know, there's a lot more cooperation with other schools than there used to be. Universities are part of consortia now. Mm-hmm. We do this for health insurance, life insurance, a lot of our procurement. Some of this is really basic stuff that maybe universities didn't pay attention to before that we pay a lot more attention to now.
We're talking with Fred Lawrence from Brandeis University. You know, a lot of people don't understand because they went to school. The parents, the moms and dads went to school back in the 70s and 80s when they could go to school, even a private school for 10 grand, and they could go to UMass for next to nothing. How the price tag has gone up so dramatically. What are the big costs that have pushed college education to rise like astronomically much faster than everything else?
Some of the drivers we have are very similar to other industries like healthcare costs and the like. You know,
yep.
We have to insure our people. We have those same issues. But a piece that's really different for universities, two of them really. One is that we are a research university. That means a big piece of what we do is science research, and that is in fact relatively expensive. Now, when I say that, you should also keep in mind that there's a lot of supported funded research that comes in from that, from the federal government, also from foundations. So to a large extent, that's offset. But to do research on the level that we do it, is an expensive operation. I think that's not only important for us, that's important for the world in terms of what we produce. The other piece is that what we do is educate young people, and some of that is done in big rooms and some of that is done one-on-one. There are certain things that it's very hard to do more efficiently. You know, it still takes a minute to play the minute waltz.
Right.
And there are certain things that if you want to have the kind of educated populace we have, it has to be done in a labor-intensive way of highly trained, educated people.
So you mean the ratio of faculty to kids, that kind of
thing? Right. We've got about 3,700 undergraduates and 350 faculty. And that allows us to have the impact on our students that we have.
But I guess when I look at it as a layperson, okay, I understand the healthcare costs. Everybody's healthcare costs are going through the roof, and you're in the same boat as everybody else. But some of the anecdotal stuff that you hear people talking about, I mean, we've all got kids, and we all went around to all these schools and noticed that, you know, you go to Providence College, the gym is like, you know, the Olympic Village down there. They've got little TV screens on every one of those treadmill things. And you go like to Middlebury College and they've got sushi and Indian food at 3 o'clock in the morning in the cafeteria. The buildings are much nicer. There seems to be a lot more perks at college now than there were, because I assume for competitive reasons.
I think that's right. Having said that, I think at least in our piece of the business, we tend to compete based on the quality of access to faculty and the quality of the teaching. I think our buildings are good buildings. I think our dorms are good dorms. But we never got involved in that kind of arms race that a lot of schools did.
Yeah, you're not serving sushi down there at Brandeis at 2 o'clock in the morning?
Not 2 o'clock in the morning, but we serve a pretty good sushi, and we got the best kosher deli in the Boston area.
Hello.
Terrific.
Can outsiders?
Jim should come down.
Because there is not a decent kosher deli in Greater Boston. Can you agree to that, by the way?
The president of Brandeis is not going to make comments about kosher delis in the Boston area. I'm just going to tell you that the deli on our campus in the Usdan Dining Hall is a terrific deli.
Okay.
You ever been to the Carnegie in New York City?
Absolutely.
One of the great places on the planet?
Absolutely.
Fine. I just want to make sure. So when you mentioned this one-minute waltz line a minute ago, a variation on a theme, somebody would disagree with you, namely the new governor of Massachusetts. Charlie Baker has suggested that one of the ways to deal with college costs in the public sector, but obviously arguably it applies to the private sector too, is let's take a look, says Baker, at three-year degrees, and let's take a look at more online education. Forget online for a second, because a lot of people, well, you can mention it if you choose. What do you think about compressing four into three for at least some students?
I think for some students, one can certainly take a look at that. I think for our piece of the business of higher education, if you will, we are better suited for what we do in a four-year program. You know, we are trying to do two things at the same time. We are trying to train students and educate students for their first job, and that fits within what a lot of people ask in terms of what are they going to get as soon as they get out. But we're also educating them for their 10th job. And that's not just a figure of speech. They will retrain multiple times. The truth is there is a tremendous act of faith in what we do, because we are training students for a world we literally can't imagine. So how do you go about doing that? You know, I tell students that when I was in high school, I had to use a slide rule. And you know what they all say to me? They say, what's a slide rule? Absolutely. And so after they laugh, I say to them, and you know something? 30 years from now, they're going to look at your iPad and your iPod, and they're going to say, that's like slide rules. As a matter of fact, it'll happen faster than that.
But you know, the concept, I agree with President Fred Lawrence, but how do you know that 4 years is right? Why isn't it five? Why isn't it three? I mean, some of us think 4 years is right because that's what we've been doing forever. It's sort of like, why is the school day what it is? Why do we do 9 months in public school? Because that's what we've been doing since we were an agrarian culture. How do you know 4 years is right?
To a certain extent, it has been road tested for a long time. But it's not just what a mentor of mine used to call the normative value of the actual. It's not just that we've done it, so we do it. I think what we try to find, particularly at a school like ours, is by the end of 4 years, they've had enough building block courses, enough basic courses. And by the time they're juniors and certainly seniors, they're doing very advanced research and really the kind of cutting edge work, whether it's in the sciences or the social sciences, humanities, the creative arts, performing arts, that's going to give them the kind of creativity that's going to make them problem solvers down the road.
We're talking with the president of Brandeis University, Fred Lawrence. Now, this is one of the things I'm obsessed with, that the public schools no longer teach children how to write and do grammar, and they don't know grammar anymore. I wonder how much of the 4 years is taken up, even at Brandeis, where there's smart kids it's hard to get into and stuff. There's remedial work in freshman year to make up for what the K-12 education failed at in many of these schools, I assume, in yours as well.
Sure. There's basic writing requirements and there's quantitative requirements, because we need our entire citizenry to be literate in both senses of the word. So that is a piece of it. I'm not sure I would say that that's a major taking up of time over the 4 years. But keep in mind, we want them not only to be able to focus in one area, we want them to be broadly educated.
That's the liberal arts defense. And that is in part your we want to be prepared for the 10th job is in part the answer to why is liberal arts education relevant anymore, right?
That is correct.
Is this a fun job? I have to say, knowing nothing about what it's like to run a college or university, in my idle moments, we were talking about alternative careers. I often say to myself, God, would I love that job? And then I think to myself, maybe I wouldn't. How much is this fun?
This is a lot of fun.
Why'd you pause?
I'm pausing because I'm thinking of which story I want to tell you.
Tell us one.
You know, one of the biggest risks for a university president, because we talk all the time, you don't want to get caught repeating stories. So one of my jokes is just tell new ones, and then you don't get caught repeating them. So within the last week, we had a gathering yesterday of students in something called the Transition Year Program at Brandeis. This is the Myra Kraft Transition Year Program named for the late Myra Kraft.
Oh.
It was a devoted alumna of Brandeis University.
I didn't know. Is that so?
Robert Kraft,
a great
husband,
woman, I should say.
Created the endowment opportunity for this program for us. These are kids who come from largely from the New England area, who we recruit to Brandeis, who clearly have the firepower to be successful, but we also know if we threw them right into college, it's not going to work. They need that transition time to be ready for school. Hearing their stories, right, the one who tells me about, you know, how nervous she is coming to Brandeis, and then just seeing the other kids and the TYP, the Transition Year Program alumni. And she doesn't mean the ones who are out of Brandeis. She means juniors or seniors who still remember that experience. Right, I had a student who was a neuroscience major by the time I met him. He was a junior or senior at that point, who was a Transition Year Program kid. I said to him, what's harder, Transition Year Program or the research you're doing in neuroscience? He said, Transition Year Program, clearly. I said, how come? He said, because that was the year I wasn't sure I could do it. He said, now that I've done that, anytime something gets hard, I say to myself, I know I can do it. You spend time with kids like that, this is a fun job.
And one of the other fun jobs is you told me when I met you at a GBH board meeting a couple of months ago is that you are the first president in the history of Brandeis. Is this correct? To actually live in Waltham where Brandeis is that right?
That is correct. My wife and I wanted to be walking distance of campus. In fact, I'll tell you, I describe this as a Brandeisian Rorschach test. When we moved to Waltham, we said we wanted to be walking distance of campus. And I instantly got three batches of emails, and they were all true. One was from my observant Jewish students who said it was good to be walking distance of campus for them to be able to come up to our house on the Sabbath and for me to be able to walk to campus on Sabbath, and that's true. I also heard from my sustainability and environmentally conscious kids who said, Mr. President, it's good for you not to be driving to work, and that's also true. And then I heard from my health-conscious kids and my athletes who said, Mr. President, it's a little better for you to be walking to work than to be driving to work. And they're all true, as long as I don't get caught driving to work.
You know, one last thing on the financial front. There was a Globe story. I'm sure you had to deal with a lot of the fallout. Jehuda Reinhardt's one of your predecessors. You succeeded him, did you not?
I succeeded him, that's right.
Several million dollars in payouts, some deferred compensation, some as president emeritus. There was a petition signed by some students and faculty essentially saying, and I'm paraphrasing, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, this is an indefensible expenditure. Was it indefensible? I know it's a board decision, not yours.
It's a board decision, and obviously it's one that precedes me. He had a long, distinguished term. Yehuda served for 16 years before me. I think it is fair to say that he transformed the campus. Also, coming out of all that, we changed a lot of the rules in terms of compensation. I think I may be one of the only private school presidents whose compensation is reported to my colleagues in real time, not on the time delay that federal rules allow us to do. And we have a rule in place that when the time comes that I step down, that my package will all be made public to the university at the time of it.
Well, that's one of the things, but before we get off the money thing, that looking at the time when those stories about your predecessor were in the paper, I mean, he was up there. I think he was 11th at one point in the country and stuff, but a lot of other presidents were making millions of dollars as president of the university and many millions when you counted their deferred compensation. That's one of the things, to me, and maybe I'm mistaken, that does seem to have changed, is that you have a lot of professors who are, especially in law schools, you know, that Elizabeth Warren got in trouble during her campaign.
That was one of Scott Brown's attacks.
Yeah, she was making $350,000 or something for teaching one course. And people say, well, you have to get the good lawyers to come in and teach the course. And they make a lot of money in the private sector, et cetera. But that the people at the top at universities, and then there's a lot of administrators, are making big bucks, which they didn't used to make. And that this idea now, and it's everywhere, that people that run big institutions in America should be making many millions of dollars, become part of the expectation. But hasn't that become part of the expectation in colleges too, that to get the Fred Lawrences of the world, we got to open up our wallets or else somebody else is going to get them kind of thing?
Look, I think this is a competitive business like anything else. The fact is, none of us went into this for the money.
Right.
If money were the prime object, I'd be practicing law in New York right now. I spent 5 years as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. We called that the best law firm in America. That's when Rudy Giuliani was the U.S. attorney. Many of my colleagues went into private practice. I didn't. I became a university president, ultimately university professor before that. I think you do have to compensate people, by the way, not just at the administrative ranks, at all of the ranks. That's appropriate with their level of training. When you think about, you know, who my colleagues are and how many years they take in training, they have to be treated appropriately. So I think that's true throughout the ranks.
But it changed, though. I guess that's my question. It seems to have changed. When you look at what people used to make, and this is including inflation and all that, it's nowhere near what they're making now. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think
In the ancient days when I was in college, people were not making this kind of money.
No, I think that's right. But I think that is also not true in many places in the economy. And I think we have a smaller piece of that than many other places. I also would say that when you actually look at the overall cost of higher education, cost of administration typically is a smaller piece of it. It's a great soundbite. It's something that people can grab onto. But in my staff, for example, you know, our total administrative cost of my whole senior team is at or about what it was before I came in and actually sometime before that.
What was it like working for Giuliani?
He was a great boss.
Really was a great boss?
He was a great boss for me. I was the chief of the Civil Rights Unit. So I can tell you that, you know, I got a chance to see him on statutes and cases that he was less familiar with because his experience really was more in organized crime, public corruption, narcotics cases. So I got a chance to watch how fast he went from 0 to 60. He went from 0 to 60 very fast and a very loyal boss.
Speaking of civil rights, I know that's your background. Days from now, any day actually, we're going to find out whether a grand jury is going to indict the police officer out there in Ferguson. And one of the arguments that's being made in anticipation of no indictment is be calm, one, because that's a responsible thing to do, and two, because the Justice Department is going to be looking into this as to see whether there were civil rights violations of Michael Brown. Is based on what you know from afar, is there a case for the Justice Department here vis-a-vis Brown's civil rights?
Very hard to guess this from afar. From what I can tell, there certainly is a basis for a close investigation. And I think it's important, and from what I understand this is happening, that they look both at the individual officers involved, but also more systemically, are there questions of the entire enterprise. The other piece of this that's hard to describe to people is that without reaching the level of an indictment, there's an awful lot that can still be looked at.
Like, what do you mean?
Well, there may be issues that require administrative restructuring of the department.
Oh, I see.
There may be lots of things where nobody actually gets punished, but at the same time, we don't just say, let's go on with business as usual.
You know, one of the things you have to deal with, President Fred Lawrence of Brandeis, which tons of presidents at some of the most prestigious universities in America, is all this sexual assault stuff that's going on. Brandeis is one of the schools named amongst the 70-plus cited, I guess, by the Department of Education. But you're in a weird position, if I got this right, is most of these schools were cited because of, I'm using a term loosely, inadequate or questionable treatment of the victim. You're on the list because of arguably your treatment of the alleged perpetrator. Is that not right in this case?
Well, obviously you'll understand I can't comment on a particular case.
But okay, tell us what
the Department of Education. What I can tell you is that we take this issue enormously seriously. I know all universities do. Twice a year, all of the research university presidents get together, the Association of American Universities. We just talked about this at our meeting 2 weeks ago. I have rarely seen my colleagues as focused on an issue as
this
issue.
We had Jimmy Carter on the other day. I don't know if you've seen his new book, A Call to Action, about violence and subjugation of women around the world and in the United States. He was particularly harsh, correct me if I'm wrong, Marjorie, on university presidents, saying that on this whole sexual assault thing, that it is in their interest to basically tamp things down, keep them inside, because the fear is, and I'm slightly putting words in his mouth, but not much, the next parent of the next applicant is going to be concerned about going to school X or Y if they think this is a breeding ground for sexual assault. Is this criticism unfounded?
I think with all due respect to the president, it's a much more complicated, subtle issue than that. I think we are all putting lots of resources into it. I can tell you, for example, that whereas we have made other cuts to bring our budget in line, as I said earlier, we've actually expanded our programming in this area, bringing on more professionals, professionalizing the entire structure. This used to be dealt with, like most disciplinary matters, with student panels. We now have professionalized it decidedly because these are very complex issues, almost close to a criminal adjudicatory system. We are really much better in educating than we are in adjudication. That said, let's make it clear, if there's even one case of sexual assault on our campus, that's one case too many. This is something we have to pay very, very close attention to and give great dedication to.
You know what I wonder? This yes, it means yes thing. In other words, you have to proceed every time you're in some encounter with a couple. Yes, yes, before you go on to the next move. If you're having sex with someone, yes, you can do this. Yes, you can do that. And some people think it's a great idea. Some people think it's a ridiculous idea. What do you think?
You know, a lot of these cases that people worry about are really not the he said, she said cases.
Yep.
A lot of them are cases where I think if you knew the facts, you would say something really ought to be done about that and something serious ought to be done about that. So that's where we really are focusing our attention. And many of these are cases of pretty serious misconduct. Now, there are lots of others throughout the system that are less than that. And that's where I think you get some of the concern that people have, aren't we getting involved in areas that we shouldn't be involved in? But keep in mind, we are educative institutions. So a big piece of what we do is teaching young people and educating young people on how they ought to be relating to each other in a whole host of ways. And their intimate lives is a piece of that.
And we're talking with Fred Lawrence. He's the president of Brandeis University. You know, I think a lot of people have the misconception that Brandeis is a school for Jewish kids. But that's obviously not true.
Well, it is a school that has a strong Jewish identity.
Yep.
It is a school for Jewish kids. Let's make that clear. But not only for Jewish kids,
okay,
which is obviously what you meant.
Yes, it is what I meant.
That it's a school that historically, you know, founded by the American Jewish community, dedicated to the proposition that there would be no discrimination on our campus. I have to remind students, in 1948, when we were founded, not only was there discrimination on university campuses with some pretty high-name schools, but it was a standard practice. Quotas that were clearly said. We have never had that. I'm one of the few university presidents who never has to apologize for any admissions policy that my school has ever had, and I say that with enormous pride. That's true about religion. That's true about race. That's true about gender. That's true about sexual orientation. We have never had any discrimination. That said, we have a particular identity in our roots in the American Jewish community, and you see this in lots of ways. You see this in the fact that our calendar is a Jewish calendar. You see that in the way that...
What does it mean? You close for the Jewish holidays? That kind of thing?
Absolutely. That we close not only for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, but we've closed for probably some of the ones you haven't heard of, like the beginning and end of Sukkot.
Oh, really?
University is not in session during Passover. So that's sort of one piece of it. We have a particularly close connection with Israel. We are inextricably connected with the state of Israel. And that's not a political statement. That's about an engagement and a close connection as part of the joint journey that we are on. We have an Israel Studies Center at Brandeis, which is at least the top Israel Studies Center outside of the state of Israel. I might be parochial and say the top one in the world, but certainly outside of the state of Israel. Middle Eastern Studies Center, the top Near Eastern and Judaic Studies program in the country, as well as a Hebrew language program. But you also see it in the life of the student body. We have a very interesting program, important program, called BVIEW, which is a student group, stands for Brandeis Visions of Israel in an Evolving World. I just met with the BVIEW leadership about 2 days ago. 20 students from every political view on Israel you can imagine, in the same room, talking with each other and engaging in a respectful way. You know what I told them? I said, because we can do it here at Brandeis, we have to. This is a model for how discussion on these issues can take place, because it comes from a position of shared commitment and it comes from a position of mutual respect. Whereas on many campuses, I'm afraid there's a lot more heat than light being shed on these issues.
What's the project you're working on now that should most excite potential attendees down the line? What's the future thing that Fred Lawrence is embracing?
Well, I would say two things. One, for our undergraduates, that they feel right away, we have a seamlessness of the undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools that most universities can only dream of. What I mean by that, if you are interested in the sciences as a young person, by the time you are a junior and sometimes even a sophomore, you are doing the functional equivalent of graduate-level research with a principal investigator who's a world-class scientist who's there to teach undergraduates. If you are interested in business or economics, while you're a junior, sometimes even a sophomore, you're doing coursework up at the business school and you're doing work in international economics and finance. If you're in the humanities, if you're in the creative and performing arts, I can do similar examples of this so that I don't see it as 4 years as an undergraduate and then think about what happens. You're going to give me 4 years. We can do remarkable things in those 4 years together in terms of the breadth of your education, but also the depth that you're able to do, because of the research university that we are. So
okay.
That's one thing I would say.
Let's end with this if we can, because it's probably most important to me. What's the single best thing on the Jewish deli menu at Brandeis? And don't hold back, Fred Lawrence.
Well,
tell
you
us
know,
the truth here.
For me,
yeah,
I got to be careful here, right? It's turkey on rye, right?
Turkey.
You know why? You know why?
Please.
You know, I go there with my chief of staff,
really,
who's probably listening, right? He tells me pastrami, and I say to him, the turkey is why I prefer. The pastrami is okay with my rabbi, but it's still not okay with my cardiologist.
Jill will be down soon to check it out. Fred Lawrence, thank you
pleasure.
So much for being
good
here.
To see you.
Brandeis is a great school, beautiful campus. I'm glad you're having fun down there. Fred Lawrence is the president of Brandeis University. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Good being with you.
Okay, coming up, we're going to ask you about the cost of higher ed. How are you working around the stratospheric prices of getting a degree? How are your kids working around it? Are you coming out of college hugely in debt? 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970.